removal of the roadless rule won't in and of itself increase timber harvest, but it will take down the barriers that are preventing some things from happening.
An appeals court issues an important decision for the Tongass National Forest. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, what the 64 earthquake felt like on a boat south of Kodiak.
The boat started to vibrate, and it was just like a giant had a hold of that boat, and it was just shaking. Rattle, rattle, shake, shake, shake.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A federal appeals court issued an opinion today saying the roadless rule should not apply to Alaska's Tongass National Forest. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The rule was enacted nationwide about a dozen years ago. It prohibits logging and other industrial activity in national forest lands without roads. The Tongass Forest, the nation's largest, was later granted an exemption. That was struck down 3 years ago in U.S. District Court, and the rule was reimposed. The Forest Service did not appeal that decision, but the state of Alaska did. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals granted its request. Tom Lenhart is the state attorney involved in the case.
Removal of the roadless rule won't in and of itself increase timber harvest or mining or anything like that, but it will take down the barriers that are preventing some things from happening.
The Ninth Circuit Court's decision does not immediately lift the rule. It sent the case back to the lower court to decide whether additional environmental review is needed. Buck Lindekugel is an attorney for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. It's one of a dozen groups that sued to bring back the roadless rule.
The reality is the decision does not immediately reinstate the Tongass exemption, and the Forest Service's actions have shown that it has no desire to go back to the damage, expense, and controversy associated with roadless area logging on the Tongass.
Forest Service officials referred calls about the ruling to the Department of Justice. The staffer handling the issue could not be reached for comment by this report's deadline. Plaintiff's attorney Tom Waldo of Earth Justice says the decision won't change much. That's because the Forest Service is already moving away from the type of timber sales the roadless exemption allows.
And I think that's where the future direction of the policy debate is going to lie, rather than trying to turn the clock back in time to fight the battles of the 1990s over whether we should be logging in roadless areas of old growth on the Tongass.
The state has a different view. Again, attorney Tom Lenhart.
We're hoping that the Forest Service will meet its obligations to seek to meet timber demand, and that we feel that some sale from roadless areas is necessary to do that. So I'm sure the state will continue to use every means available to encourage the Forest Service to take actions that will further a certain level of development.
The state, the timber industry, and other development groups have been pressuring the Forest Service to allow more logging. That includes a proposal calling for the federal government to turn over or sell some Tongass lands. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says she's normally not one for drama, but she has stepped up the rhetoric on one issue, the King Cove Road. Murkowski says Interior Secretary Sally Jewell is the only person standing between the people of King Cove and their access to an all-weather airport for medical evacuations. Jewell went before a Senate panel to defend the president's budget today, and as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Murkowski seized the opportunity.
Before Jewell had said a word at today's hearing, Murkowski spoke for 15 minutes about the road. Murkowski reminded the secretary she has a trust responsibility to the mostly Aleut population of King Cove.
The notion from your department that you must protect Alaska from Alaska Natives, our first people, it's insulting.
Murkowski has been hammering Jewell in the press for months over her decision in December rejecting the road, which would go 10 miles through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge to Cold Bay. She advertised her fury today with an incredible Hulk scarf draped around her shoulders, a nod to the late Senator Ted Stevens. Murkowski says Jewell has done nothing to advance her promise to look into alternatives for King Cove. At a press conference after the hearing, Murkowski ridiculed Jewell for telling her in a private meeting that she'd made some phone calls about improving marine access for King Cove.
Well, go talk to the Corps of Engineers about a breakwater, because I've been fighting to get breakwaters and docks in the state of Alaska for the 12 years that I've been here. And we've got a 20-year backlog. How are you going to get a breakwater?
Murkowski and King Cove leaders on hand for the press conference say a road is the only viable option. King Cove EMT Bonita Babcock says plenty of Americans care about the refuge, but too few about her critically ill and injured patients.
We need people to care enough about their lives, about their beating hearts, and to understand that they're worth more than some eelgrass and some ducks.
Senator Mark Begich and the King Cove delegation met privately with Jewell yesterday. At the hearing, he questioned Jewell about the road for 5 minutes, then moved on to other issues such as contaminated land and the backlog of contract support costs owed to Native health organizations. The Interior Department has a huge role in Alaska. It's essentially the landlord for 60% of Alaska and oversees the BIA. Murkowski says she will have to work with Jewell on a large number of issues, but she says the road for King Cove is non-negotiable. Outside the hearing, Jewell reiterated the reasons she opposes the road. Jewell says it would run over a sensitive strip of land between two lagoons.
It is a very, very important and unique habitat, and the determination by the Fish and Wildlife Service is that a road would be very disruptive through that area.
If Murkowski's repeated assertions that she's heartless bother her, Jewell doesn't show it. She says she respects Murkowski's passion. Senator Lamar Alexander, a Tennessee Republican, said at the hearing Murkowski and Jewell are both highly respected and would be likely allies if it weren't for this one issue. Alexander says he hopes they can work out a resolution. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The deadline to sign up for health insurance is next Monday, March 31st. To accommodate the last-minute rush, the Obama administration announced this week you'll be able to enroll as long as you begin the process before the end of the month. After that, you won't be able to buy coverage on healthcare.gov or anywhere unless you have a qualifying life event like getting married or having a child. APRN's Annie Feit has been talking with Alaskans as they navigate the complicated health law. For this story, she checked back in with two people who've had very different experiences.
Alex Kruver hasn't had to use his health insurance yet, but he's very happy to have it. He reaches into his back pocket and proudly pulls out a white and blue Primera Alaska card.
Yeah, there it is.
Kruver has asthma, and because of that, he knows he needs health insurance, but it's always consumed a big chunk of his monthly budget. The last plan he had cost him about $200 a month. When he logged on to healthcare.gov, Kruver found he qualified for a subsidy that would bring the cost of a mid-level silver plan down to just $70 a month.
It just means I have more money. It's what it means. I have more money now for myself.
Kruver is a jazz musician who also works a part-time retail job. He earns about $25,000 a year. He's already paid his first few health insurance bills, and he says the Affordable Care Act offers him a very good deal.
Well, for me, yeah, it's great. I'm very satisfied. It's like it was meant for me, basically. But, like, I can't say the same for everyone. You know, some people are pretty angry about it.
Including Mark Knapp. He and his wife Angel own a custom knife shop in Fairbanks. Until last December, they were happy paying $750 a month for health insurance from Primera. But because the plan didn't meet Affordable Care Act requirements, it was canceled. President Obama then extended many canceled plans for a year, but the Knapp's plan didn't qualify.
So we decided we'd shop around.
On healthcare.gov, Knapp found a similar plan to the one the couple had for $1,260 a month. The subsidy the couple qualified for brought down the cost to $700. But Knapp says he and his wife didn't feel right about accepting a subsidy.
It doesn't really fall under affordable health care to me. even though I wasn't going to pay it all, somebody was going to have to pay it for me.
So instead, the Knapps got a policy through a small business organization they belong to. The monthly premium is $850.
So that's about $100 a month more than what we were getting it for with Primera.
And that's $150 more than what they would be required to pay on healthcare.gov. The plan doesn't comply with the Affordable Care Act, so it's scheduled to be canceled at the end of this year. After that, Knapp isn't sure what he and his wife will do, but he says they won't ever feel right about accepting a subsidy.
We were looking at just paying the taxes, or whatever you call it, the penalty for not signing up for Obamacare, and then paying for any medical care we needed ourselves.
Knapp says his wife puts things much more bluntly, saying, "No way, no how are we signing up for national health care." In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Seward Peninsula residents object to a proposed graphite mine.
We did not have any input in the decision-making process, so we kind of feel left out. It's going to affect our food security.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Tomorrow, March 27th, marks the 50th anniversary of Alaska's Good Friday earthquake, the largest recorded in North America. Many Sitkins have stories from the epicenter. Bob Allen is known around Southeast now for his family shipbuilding and cruise business, Allen Marine. But 5 decades ago, he was fishing south of Kodiak Island, far from his family, when disaster struck. Allen says when you can't take care of your own, you take care of what you can. KCAW's Emily Foreman has the story.
Bob Allen was over 100 miles from home when a magnitude 9.2 earthquake rocked his boat. Of all days, this would be a tough one to be separated from his wife and kids.
Betty and the kids were in Kodiak, and I was on a 104-foot fishing boat. It was about 5 o'clock. Beautiful day, flat calm, absolutely mere calm. And the boat started just vibrating. It was just like a giant had a hold of that boat, and it was just shaking it. Just rattle, rattle, shake, shake, shake. Terrible vibration.
The violent jostling had damaged the radio. All they could do was listen.
We could hear what was happening in Kodiak.
And the report wasn't good.
He says, "How are you doing?" And he says, "Oh, I'm doing okay." He said, "Well, where are you at?" And he says, "I'm sitting in the schoolyard."
That is floating over the schoolyard in an 80-foot barge. Just as devastating, but even more deadly than the earthquake itself, was the tsunami that followed.
The schoolyard in Kodiak was pretty far up above the waterline. You knew that that town had been underwater by 10 or 15, 20 feet by then.
Bob knew his home wasn't flooded because it was on a hill above the schoolyard, but he couldn't be sure that his house hadn't collapsed on his family. And the tsunami waves made it too risky to go home.
We're kind of pinned. We couldn't do anything. When you reach a point where there's nothing that you can do to take care of your own family, you just say, "Okay, I'll take care of what I can, somebody else's family, and somebody else is going to look after mine, I hope."
That night over the radio, Allen's crew learned that the village of Kaguyak had been wiped out. It was only 8 miles away. Come morning, they set out to help.
They were all on the beach. They were right at the head of the bay, right where the old village had been. They had no food. They had no blankets. All they had was that one little radio. And we brought out 46 adults and probably 15 children and one body. They were in shock. Couldn't think for themselves. You'd take them over to the table and you'd set them down with a plate in front of them in a hot cake. And we'd made that sugar syrup. We had a big can of sugar syrup going all the time. We left there and we headed for Old Harbor because they were wiped out too. And we're going through hundreds of empty oil barrels, overturned boats, broke up houses, deep freezers, refrigerators, anything that could float.
By the time that they left Old Harbor, they had 96 adults and 35 kids on board. The plan was to transport the survivors to the Kodiak Naval Base. Many had taken a few valued possessions along with them, and when they pulled into shore...
It was just like tying up in a river. The tide is still, every 25, 30 minutes, is going from full high to full low.
They were asked to leave these items on the dock while they boarded the buses. When the buses pulled away, the water seeped through the dock and...
Everything they had saved floated away. I get home, by then it's about 2:30 in the morning.
On Sunday, 33 hours since the start of the quake.
They were not allowing anybody into the middle of town without a guard.
For fear of looting, an armed guard escorted Bob home.
That was the worst part of the whole thing for me, was coming home and finding my family gone. All there is a note on the table from Betty saying that they went to Chiniac. 12 people had drowned on those roads because they got caught in the head of the bays. And that
12 frantic hours later,
I'm panic-stricken.
Bob finally got a call that his wife and kids had been evacuated to Chiniac by plane and were safe.
After that, I got off the boat. I quit fishing and went to work construction. And
Did you quit fishing because of this experience?
Well, there were no canneries left. There's no place left to sell a crab anyway. When you're growing up in Alaska, it's kind of like a walking disaster area anyway. Everything always gets rebuilt. That's not, you know, it's no problem. It always happens. I don't think you're standing up there waving a flag or anything. There ain't a lot of glory in this world.
In Sitka, I'm Emily Foreman.
The community of Seward on Resurrection Bay was hit hard by the 64 earthquake and tsunami. 7 tidal waves in all hammered the town in the hours after the quake. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer brings us some of the voices of those who witnessed that terrible day.
We looked halfway down the bay there and we see the wave standing up on with the white comber on top, and we decided to move to get out of here.
When that wave was coming down on us, we didn't worry about it too much because we knew that from being sailors that waves out on the ocean travel about 15, 18 miles an hour. This baby was going about 50 miles an hour. There's white water peeling right off the top of it.
We couldn't get out of the car because we was pinned in between the big trees that were in here, and we had to kick a window out to get out of the vehicle. And that's when we got out and jumped up on that boat that slammed into our car, and we got up on top of that boat deck and we could visually see around what was happening. Everything we owned here was gone.
The water at the head of the bay, it was a great big wall of water, like it just jumped right up there. It had a bunch of boats on top of it. It was just moving right out into the ocean. And right alongside of our building, the cracks were opening up and closing and shooting water right up in the air.
I was well away from the waterfront. But I did happen to see a locomotive on the crest of a wave, and this locomotive probably weighed, I would say, 80 or 90 ton, and it just tossed that locomotive for like 200 feet across the street.
The first tidal wave picked that burning fuel up and swept it all down what is 7th Avenue today, and then it swept it right into Tesoro, which was at the opposite end of town, and it ignited that fuel. Plus what the railroad had, all their fuel cars were upside down and in a mess, and that fuel burned for days.
And so we could hear the explosions in town. I remember seeing was this gondola, railroad gondola, with a van in it. And it was down in the boat harbor, and we were all standing there looking at it, and it's fire. It's covered with oil and burning. And it goes back and forth, and all of a sudden it just went whoosh, and everything went topsy-turvy. And here's the van sitting on the highway, on the road, and the gondola's gone. Not a trace of the gondola. It's just whoosh, gone.
All of a sudden, just at the front door was my father, and he's yelling, "There's a tidal wave coming. We have to get to the top of the roof." We jumped, and it seems as if as soon as my dad got onto the house roof, and we were all lying down with our hands and heads at the pitch of the roof and holding hands, that wave just hit so hard and so fast that just in an instant, what had been a subdivision of probably 11 homes was instantly just gone. Everything just exploded or flattened, and we went from the ground up to the very tops of those trees. We were just like a cork, just 0 to 60 in just a split second.
Then we took off on probably the wildest ride. You can imagine, we were spinning. I remember spinning around. We were bouncing off trees. And
really, for a reason that is not even able to be explained, we weren't swept off by the wave or by enormous tree branches. And we all just held on and we just rode, sort of like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz.
As we were spinning around, we got stuck between two or three trees. And just shortly after that, we could hear another wave coming.
All night long, there would be a Jeep go through with an old siren, because you see, the power had gone off, which meant that the warning sirens, there was no power to them. So this old Jeep went through town with this siren hand wound, and somebody screaming, "Get out, get out. Tsunami coming, tidal wave coming. Get out, go to high ground."
And about that time, a station wagon came just flying out from town and hit the bridge, and the bottom part of his car slammed against the bridge, and he bounced in the air and came over the bridge and slammed on his brakes and slid to a stop. And he screamed at us, "Turn around, turn around. There's a tidal wave coming. Seward's going to be washed away. Turn around, turn around." And then he took off.
Those are some of the voices from people who witnessed the earthquake and following tsunamis in Seward on March 27, 1964.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering dental innovations from implants and Invisalign with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. Salmonlove.com. This message brought to you by The Salmon Project.
Vancouver-based Graphite One Resources announced this month they've finalized all land purchases for a promising graphite claim on the Seward Peninsula. But village residents in the area are concerned the proposed mine could harm subsistence resources. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Graphite One Resources has already drilled some exploratory holes at their claim. Vice President Dean Besser says they'll do more work this summer to measure the mine's economic potential.
That the resource is actually viable or looks to be viable for mining.
This summer, the company will stage operations from a camp off the Teller Road with more employees working in Nome testing deposit samples. Gerald Brown, a vice president at the Bering Straits Regional Corporation, says they've worked with Graphite One the last 2 years helping with logistics. Graphite One has attracted a lot of interest. The city of Nome has referred to the potential value of its deposit in order to bolster claims for building a deep draft port. And at Monday's Common Council meeting, Port Project Manager Joy Baker spoke of getting inquiries about graphite ore transport from a shipping company based in Norway. But so far, the mining company has not reached out to the nearby communities of Brevik Mission or Teller, both of which would be directly affected if the deposit is mined. Albert Aquilic has served on the Mary's Igloo Traditional Council based in Teller since 2005. He says the potential mine site is one of the most important subsistence grounds for people living in the area.
The importance of the Graphite Creek area, it's a food source, seasonal food source. We get moose and muskox and reindeer occasionally, and migratory birds, when they migrate through there, it's an abundant resource. And we also get a lot of our berries for the winter there.
There's also fishing and a small seal harvest from nearby waterways. Aquilic says nobody with the 3 IRAs close by were aware of the claim's development status, nor have they been contacted by anyone from the company about the possibility of open-pit mining near a prime food and water source.
Yeah, we also haven't heard from this company. Now the settlement is final on that, and there is no input. We did not have any input in this, in the decision-making process, so we kind of feel left out. It's going to affect our food security.
Matt Ganley is in charge of land and resources for BSNC and says that while they've helped Graphite One with logistics in the region, that has not included contacting any tribal governments. Besser says that Graphite One is waiting until after the Alaska Mining Conference this April to reach out to communities close to the deposit.
Well, we understand that we need to have a presence in the community and educate both the people and the shareholders in the area as to what's going on with respect to Graphite One's exploration campaign, and we aim to do that in both the spring and summer of this year.
Joe Price, project manager for Graphite One, says the company held off reaching out to tribes in the region until work on the mine was further along. That way, they'd have firmer information on hand for meetings. For Can-OM in Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
A winter house set up by Bethel's Lions Club recently completed its 90-day project. Their goal was to eliminate winter death by exposure. KYUK's Charles Enoch has more.
Eight people from the Lions Club in Bethel met last year in October with one goal in mind, to eliminate death by exposure in the community during the cold winter months. Eva Malvich, the chair of the Bethel Winter House Lions Club, says since the winter house opened, she's seen the difference that a little food and shelter can make.
At least three of our clients have found full-time jobs. Two have moved out and are renting their own place. So we're seeing some progress right there.
During their first season, Bethel Winter House served just over 20 clients on an average night, quite possibly saving lives. All of the clients were Alaska Native, ranging in age from 20 to over 60 years old. The founders knew the shelter would be run solely by volunteers and supplied by donations, so they decided to start with just a seasonal pilot project during the coldest 3 months of the year. The hardest part of the project, Malvich says, was finding volunteers to monitor the shelter. Another challenge was providing nutrition for the clients.
We thought meals would be a nice thing, but we couldn't promise our clients that it would be there every night, and so far every night we've had a meal.
Since their first opening at Christmas time, the shelter has helped dozens of people, but it still has been a tough winter.
With our goal for zero death by exposure, we had lost one individual by the name of Marvin Payne, and another client of ours who had spent the night from a nearby village had succumbed to hypothermia.
The Bethel Winter House closed Monday morning on the 24th of this month, but Malvich says she and her volunteers are ready to do it again next year. Reporting in Bethel, this is Charles Enoch.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Emily Foreman in Sitka, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, and Charles Enoch in Bethel. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Register today for the 2014 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, May 1st and 2nd at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. This sixth annual event offers an unmatched opportunity to learn about the latest policies, programs, and projects related to renewable energy and energy efficiency. Early registration ends March 28th. More information at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. Clean energy, it's everyone's business. This message sponsored by REAP.
Registration is open for the Alaska Trails 2014 Trails Conference, April 24th through 26th in Anchorage. Agenda and more information at alaska-trails.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Trails.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.